Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the polarizing statue of Frank Rizzo has been taken down from its spot near Philadelphia City Hall, and the Rizzo mural has been painted over. Paula Peebles of the National Action Network will weigh in. Also, as sports stars speak out about the death of George Floyd, pro leagues try to get the ball rolling on seasons suspended by the pandemic. We'll get the latest from Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski. But to begin, Pennsylvania's primary election this month was like none other, pushed back from its original date in late April because of a deadly virus and held amid the turbulent unrest spawned by the devastating killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer. Also because a huge number of ballots were mailed in thanks to changes in election law, results have been unusually slow to come in some areas. Philadelphia has actually stopped counting ballots for the moment, which raises questions about protocol for the general election in November. Joining us now to help get our arms wrapped around the new election normal is WHYY's Katie Meyer. Welcome back, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
So at last word, the counting of ballots had stopped in Philadelphia. What's the latest and why the pause?
Yeah, so the latest that I have been able to find this morning is that, they were expecting to resume this week. I'm not sure if they've quite done that yet, but I think we will see work starting to pick back up. For context, as you mentioned, there was a huge volume of mail-in ballots this year. It had to do with the change of election law. It also had to do with the pandemic. And so county election offices were really overwhelmed. And Philly, obviously, it's, the biggest counting enterprise that the state has to do. So it was this past Thursday, they got through in Philadelphia about half of the ballots. And then the city commissioners paused the counting because they wanted to check the poll books to make sure nobody had voted twice. So this was them sort of being careful. It's a volume of work that they have not had to deal with before. And I think they wanted to just make sure that there's no, it wouldn't even be fraud, but a lot of people requested mail-in ballots and then maybe didn't get them. The mail was slow because of the pandemic. And so then maybe they went and voted in person. There could have been mix-ups. You're supposed to, cast a provisional ballot if you haven't gotten your ballot. Hmm. But anyway, there's a lot going on. So they pause the vote, they're checking things, and then they're going to resume.
It's all brand new. I mean, before election law was changed, before really last Tuesday, relatively few could vote by mail in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year, we don't know quite yet because we're still counting how many people voted by mail, but we know how many people applied to vote by mail, and it was 1.8 million people. Mm. And so the context on that is, like, in the previous primary election, this is like 17 times more than the amount of people who voted by mail then. So it's because, like I mentioned, Pennsylvania's voting laws used to dictate that anybody who votes absentee or votes, remotely needs to have an excuse. So excuse-only absentee voting, and that, cut down significantly on the number of people who did it. Now there is no excuse absentee voting, plus they have slightly longer to get the ballot than all voters in Pennsylvania. So it was a reform intended to make it more possible for more people to vote, and very clearly people took advantage of that.
There were concerns, Katie, that many constituents who wanted to actually physically get to the polls this past Tuesday, in Philly in particular, would not be able to because there was still so much unrest in parts of the city. What was actual turnout like? Do we know?
Yeah, I think it's, it's a primary election. It's a primary election in which Pennsylvania was not going to be a player in picking the Democratic nominee for president. Joe Biden had already pretty much clinched that race. Bernie Sanders conceded. So I do think we were not expecting huge turnout anyway. Best guess that I have been able to see is maybe around like 22% turnout, which is, it's not terrible for a primary. It's not great. Again, context on that, I think in 2016 for the general election there was high turnout and it was about 70% turnout. So again, primary versus general. I don't have all the data for previous primary election turnout, but I think it was not as bad as some people thought it might be. And that is, again, down to the amount of absentee voting that happened, mail-in voting.
So at the polls, what sorts of coronavirus protections were in place, and did they seem to be working for voters and poll workers alike?
Yeah. So it's a bunch of stuff. And to their credit, you know, I mean, it could be different at different polls, but the ones that I went to over the course of Election Day, people were taking it pretty seriously. They had sort of clear plastic guards up in front of the tables where poll workers, you know, check people in at the book. It's the kind of thing that you see now at a supermarket usually. Poll workers were all wearing gloves. People were encouraged to bring their own pens. They, you know, the machines, most of the machines that people in Pennsylvania are using now, you have to fill out the ballot by hand with a pen and then feed it into a machine. And so, you know, poll workers were wiping down the machines with sanitizer after people were done. So they're definitely, I think some people had a little trouble getting going in the morning, making sure they had all the new procedures down. At certain polling places, we definitely saw some long lines at some places in Philly. And that is due to, you know, there's new voting machines, too, on top of all these new procedures people have to do in lots of counties. So, you know, again, it's all new. It's all different. But it looks like people more or less had a handle on it. And I think it was pretty uniform.
All right. Well, there are a number of races as ballots continue to be counted in the Philadelphia area, especially that really have maybe been, you know, pretty close, maybe even too close to call. One potential upset, Katie, is in Pennsylvania's 17th state Senate district, the Democratic primary race there. Incumbent state senator Dalen Leach has been under fire for a couple of several years. Anyway, can you give us a refresher on that and tell us about his challenger?
Sure. So, yeah, Dalen Leach, he's been in the state Senate for about a decade. He was always sort of a progressive standard bearer. You know, there have historically not been a lot of very left progressives in Pennsylvania's legislature, and he was one of them. He, in late 2017, was accused of sort of pervasive harassment, making women uncomfortable and on his campaign, people he worked with, sort of inappropriate touching that made people uncomfortable. And so the Senate ended up doing a whole investigation. They had an independent law firm come in and assess the misconduct. They found that Leach had not broken any laws or technically violated Senate procedure, but they said, you know, his actions have been immature. And they certainly probably made some people uncomfortable. And so after that happened, there was also there's a rape allegation that was much more serious. But, you know, that hasn't gone through the courts. And the independent investigators, you know, they couldn't confirm it one way or another. He denies it. He sued for defamation over that one. So that's kind of a side thing. But in terms of just the harassment type behaviors, he was sort of kicked out of his caucus. The Senate Democrats said he couldn't caucus with them anymore. They called his behavior like a pattern that was inappropriate. And so anyway, that was really the crux of this election. His opponent, you mentioned Amanda Cappelletti, she, you know, she's young. She's also a progressive. She's on the East Norton Board of Supervisors. She used to work for Planned Parenthood. And she, you know, I talked to both of them. She said her platform is very similar policy-wise to Leach's. She just thinks that she will be able to work better with her colleagues. And so now, as it stands, you know, that race, the Associated Press did call it for Cappelletti. Leach, as far as I've been able to tell this morning, hasn't conceded. And I don't know if she's said anything publicly, but it
They're
is,
still waiting.
Yeah, it looks like that one may have switched over.
All right. And as the ballots continue to be counted, the seat held by Pennsylvania State Senator Larry Farnese could switch hands. The community organizer Nikhil Saval calls himself a socialist. Farnese has been in office for a dozen years. And correct me if I'm wrong, Katie, but he also is considered to be a progressive. What's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are different definitions of progressive. And I do think, you know, Bernie Sanders had a lot to do with this, but sort of the Overton window on how left you can be and how overtly, you know, for, you know, very public institutions, i.e. if you're running as a socialist, you know, that shifted a little bit. And so Farnese, absolutely, you know, he's a Democrat. He votes with, you know, the left of his party, as, you know, as far as I've ever been able to observe in Harrisburg. But I think there is this feeling among young people, you know, Philadelphians are pretty liberal, that it is now time for an even bigger switch. And I think Nikhil Saval is a very good example of somebody who, embodies a new face of what the Democratic Party could look like. And I also say, I mean, Farnese, yes, he's an incumbent. Incumbents tend to have advantages. But I've also seen it pointed out, you know, it's not like he was a U.S. senator. It's not like he was, you know, the president, the governor, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Like, incumbent advantage sort of decreases if you're a state senator. You don't have quite the name recognition. So I do think it's certainly an upset. If, in fact, nothing changes, the AP has called this race. But it's not incredibly surprising. You know, I think it's just sort of, you know, Farnese has more institutional support from the old school Philadelphia, the establishment.
Yeah.
And it's very possible people want to get away from that.
All right. Let's spend about maybe a half minute or so on Pennsylvania's first congressional district. Republican incumbent Brian Fitzpatrick fended off challenger Andy Meehan, who is an avid supporter of President Trump. Fitzpatrick positions himself as a moderate, but he doesn't shy away from courting Trump supporters as well, Katie.
No, he does not. One of the big things we saw from in that area was that he was really echoing Trump's language on China when it came to the coronavirus, basically saying that China had, you know, covered up their outbreak and they were at fault for the U.S. having such a bad outbreak. And so that was interesting to see. But you're right. He usually does walk a pretty moderate path. He was cagey about whether he would vote for Trump. Last time, I believe he wrote in Mike Pence's name. Yes, it's a very moderate district. He will likely be up against Christina Finello, and she's also a relatively moderate person, the Democrat here. And so we will see what happens. And the Democrats are hoping to flip that district, but Republicans do usually have an advantage there. They have the registration edge.
All right, remains to be seen. Other races up in the air, State Representatives Maria Dottatucci, Ronnie Green, and also possibly State Representative Brian Sims. We'll keep track on that, keep track of that. Final question, Katie. November 3rd, the general election. Was the primary a real dress rehearsal? What are some of the issues that elections officials will be looking at here?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I think one of the big issues is the amount of time it's taking to count ballots here. You can imagine that if we're in a very tense general election situation, and for instance, Pennsylvania being a swing state is one of the deciding factors in who wins the presidential election, it's going to be a problem if Pennsylvania doesn't know when its ballots are all going to be counted,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I imagine, and I know these conversations are happening, you know, this question of how do we get the ballots counted accurately and more quickly so there aren't these sorts of questions that are lingering, you know, days and perhaps weeks. You know, we don't quite know how long this is going to take after the election.
5 months to iron it out, Katie.
No problem.
Thank you so much for joining us. WHYY's Katie Meyer reports on politics for us. Up next, Paula Peebles, who's chair of the Pennsylvania chapter of the National Action Network on the removal of the Rizzo statue and the painting over of the Rizzo mural in South Philadelphia. Stay with us for that.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. A defining moment in last week's protests over the death of George Floyd came during the dark hours of pre-dawn last Wednesday, when Philadelphia city workers quietly removed the statue of former mayor and police commissioner Frank Rizzo from the steps of the Municipal Services Building. Then, days later, the mural of Rizzo at the Italian Market in South Philly was painted over. Rizzo was a polarizing figure in Philadelphia's history. As Philadelphia Mayor Kenney put it, the statue is a deplorable monument to racism, bigotry, and police brutality for members of the Black community, the LGBTQ community, and many others. We will be discussing Frank Rizzo and the removal of the statue and mural. If you've got a question or comment, the email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Paula Peebles is chair of the Pennsylvania National Action Network, and she's with us now on Radio Times. Welcome, Paula.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
Let's get to the statue first. Many of us woke up Wednesday morning to TV footage of the Rizzo statue being lifted from its moorings at City Hall. What went through your mind when you first saw that video, Paula?
Jubilant, because we had worked for many years to have the Rizzo statue removed since 1999. It should never have been anchored on taxpayers' property. So when finally I saw that the Rizzo statue was being removed, I was really happy about that. During the period of time when the most recent, I should say, period of time, we actually developed a petition to have citizens in Philadelphia County to sign the petition to have the statue removed. It was when Mayor Kenney was actually coming into office. And he promised that the statue would be taken down during his first term. Of course, he did not keep his word. We pressured him. I would be in meetings with him, and I would say, you have to take that statue down. And then he changed his mind, and he changed his mind, and he changed his mind again. And the most recent was in 2022, he would have the statue taken down. So I think it was the power of the people in the streets that forced him around, not only in Philadelphia, but around the country, around the world, that forced him to see reality, that that statue was going to come down one way or the other. The young, youthful protesters had begun to try to take it down by defaming it, by damaging it. They tried everything. They tried to set it. They set it on fire. They could not removed the statue because of how it was anchored at the municipal services site. So I was very pleased that finally the statue was removed, and they did it correctly to move it in the dark of the night, because really he reflected a dark time in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, tell
us. One thing I would also say is during the time that I would have that our group had petition signed, people would, as soon as we mentioned Rizzo name, they would come right up to us and say, oh, sure. And some people would actually try to stop us and begin to tell us their story, their experience by, with Rizzo during the most brutal time, in our opinion, in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, let's talk about that, Paula. Rizzo was police commissioner in the late 60s. He was mayor from 1972 to 1980, a politician who famously urged Philadelphians to vote white. What was it like living in Philly as a black person during that time?
What was it like?
Yeah.
It was horrible. It was terrible. If you're not from Philadelphia, I will share with you, Rizzo had red police cars. Imagine red police cars coming up and down the small, narrow streets in the city of Philadelphia, in a city of neighborhoods. It was total terror. It was terror because in 1967, African-American students marched out of school in protest to the education, which continues today, poor education, maleducation of African-Americans. And Rizzo sent his stormtroopers in there and said, get their black ASS. I'm not sure of your station. You can actually say the words.
That's quite all right.
Okay. Yeah. He said, get their black asses. So that reflects our experience. It reflects our experience during that period of time. The Black Panther Party was in existence. And he constantly tried to repress, oppress the members of the Black Panther Party to the point that he raided our headquarters in the city of Philadelphia. Our captain, Reggie Shell, at that time, because of the Rizzo stormtroopers and their repression, called Rizzo out, told him to come and meet him on, at that time it was Columbia Avenue. It's now Cecil B. Moore Avenue in the heart of North Philadelphia where a temple resides. And of course, Rizzo never showed up because he was all about brute force in his mouth. When it came to actually standing up and being a man, he would fizzle out like a coward, very similar to the man that exists in the White House today.
Paula, for the time being, the statue is in storage until the city can figure out what happens next. Where should it go? What should happen to it, in your opinion?
I think it should go in the grave. And if the my Italian brothers and sisters want it, then they should find a place in South Philadelphia that's still majority Italian neighborhood and put it in their neighborhood.
Is there value in placing the statue into some sort of education setting, like a museum in which the history is discussed?
I don't think you need a statue for that. I think the history should be discussed, absolutely, because that's, I truly believe that's the only way that young white children will begin to be healed. I believe we have to look to saving and educating the next generation, because grandmom and grandpop, they're too far gone into racism. I saw some of the comments as a result of Mayor Kenney removing the statue, some of the things that people said to him, some of the words that the foremost senator, Vince Fumo, said to Mayor Kenney, and it was horrible. So I think it's important that we teach the next generation of white children about, as with all children, but particularly white children, about who Rizzo was and what he actually meant to this city. I read some of the words from his grandson, and I think it was his grandson and another relative. And I said to myself, I'd like the opportunity to sit down with them and let them know exactly who their uncle, cousin, grandfather was. He was a brute force. He did not care. He carried a nightstick to a black tie affair. Was not a good person.
What, Paula, if anything, should go up in its place at City Hall? Another statue? For instance, a number of years ago, the statue of Octavius Cato was unveiled at City Hall. An African-American educator, an abolitionist who was shot and killed nearly 150 years ago on Election Day in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Are there more monuments to Black Philadelphians in the making?
I think a statue to an African-American would be acceptable. In the county of Philadelphia, we are the majority in this county. However, I would not be so arrogant to say who it should be. I think it should be a people's choice. I think it would be great if it's someone that all ethnic groups in can unite around. I think that would be important so that we won't find ourselves in a situation where there's tension. I think it's important that the person has purpose, that the person fought for justice. And so, yes, I would be willing to support another statue going up at the Municipal Services Building. Is it a part of a requirement going forward? No. You could put a waterfall there, and I would be fine with that.
Let's talk about what happens after the unrest and the peaceful protest that happened in the city of Philadelphia following the death of George Floyd. Mayor Kenney says he'll form a steering committee with the goal of reconciliation with Philadelphians. Also, Kenney and Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw are pledging to address use of force policies. You know, steering committees, pledges, is this the start you are looking for?
No. No, because it sounds like to me it's the police policing the police again. And that's what has given to the unrest the rebellion, as we refer to it, the rebellion that's going on throughout the states. The police cannot police themselves. The reason that the police most likely would have gotten away with the murder of George Floyd is because their buddies are the DA. It's an internal issue within the policing system of the United States. No, the selection and resolution around this matter has to come from the bottoms up. It cannot come from the top down. Through all our lives, it has come from the top down. It has to come from the bottoms up. And that's what you're seeing going on throughout the United States with the young, particularly the young, that are standing up saying no more. Even the young whites, and sometimes the groups are more whites than African Americans. What we're saying is, and what they're saying is, that their friends are African Americans. No longer do they want to deal with the original sin of America, of racism. However, it does have to be confronted. It's painful, but it has to be confronted, and it has to be addressed by all people, not just African Americans.
So, Paula, if people of color move into law enforcement, can the system be changed from the inside out, in your opinion?
No, because we've done that. I worked as a part of a group, Rally for Justice, to get Commissioner Danielle Outlaw here. It was not an easy task in discussion with Mayor Kenney in his cabinet. But in the end, he recognized that it most likely would be a good decision. So what I'm saying to answer your point is, no, not all the time is that that's the case. Most of the time, it's a matter of us having to push, pursue, sign petitions, march, and it's consistent. But you have to have the right people at the table to get the right results. I've been listening to some of the news today, and they're reflecting on South Africa and the Reconciliation Commission that they had in South Africa. America is not South Africa. Our sojourn, African-American sojourn in America, is different from that of our brothers and sisters in South Africa. They were at home. We have been snatched from the mother continent. We were in a strange land, and we were still and still are trying to find our way to some level of equity and parity economically.
What do you want to see change first and foremost within the Philadelphia Police Department and its communication, its work with communities of color?
What would I like to see first?
Yeah.
I would like to see first, I would say one of the priorities must be that Commissioner Outlaw is willing to remove police that are racist. That cannot leave. We have footage that have been given to us during the recent protests where police are still attacking, brutalizing people. One of the footage, a man is saying up in Germantown, "I can't breathe." And the police officer says, "Don't try that sugar honey iced tea here. It's not going to work." She needs to address her police. And sincerely, when she sets the tone, she follows through. That is not a vile threat. That's one of the first things she needs to do.
In Philadelphia, Paula, as in so many cities, there has been obviously anguish about the brutal killing of George Floyd. There's been breathtaking peaceful protest and so much destruction. Let's talk about the destruction. Few would argue that the anger isn't justified, but does the destruction help or hinder the civil rights process moving forward?
It does not hinder the fight for justice. It does not harm it. I think that was a moment in time. We are a movement. That was a moment when the youth came out and through their anger, they were just so fed up that they acted out. And that's what happened in that matter. It's under control. I think they've recognized the fact that no longer will we allow them to harm the businesses in our community. And that was not, even though they were angry and they were seeking revenge against a system that have continually had their foot on their neck, that we have to move forward and past that. That was a moment in this struggle, not a part of the movement of the struggle for equality, for parity, economic parity in this country. We talk about police brutality. We talk about policing, but it's not just policing. It's our health care where we are dying more than any other ethnic group from COVID. It's about Black women's mortality. We're dying in childbirth more than any other group in this country. It's a holistic approach when it comes to reconciliation with the citizens of African descent that reside in America. It's not a single issue that needs to be addressed. It's the police, because right now, because the police is the brute force. But when I go to the hospital, it's whether I have a doctor that does not see my skin as my sin and actually is going to take care of my health because he sees me as a human being. So it depends on where we find ourselves as a people, how we are treated within a system that's been structurally set up against us.
So Paula Peebles, in your opinion, will the death of George Floyd and the resulting protest and unrest that followed, is this going to force a real turning point in the fight for reform?
Oh, I definitely believe it will, because the young people, as well as those of myself who've been in a, I've been in a movement since I was 15 years old. And we're not going back. There's nothing back for us. During the COVID 19 sheltering in for 8 weeks, 10 weeks, whatever it was, if you listen to Austin during the period, that period of time, and you would hear African Americans of conscience speak, excuse me, in comparison to that of white people, they would say, we want a sense of normality. We're going to arm ourselves and we're going to the Michigan Capitol, et cetera, to force this country to reopen. And then you would hear African Americans say, we're not going back to normality. That normal is not good for us. So, yes, you call it reform. We call it onward. We have to develop ourselves. We have to force America to recognize that African Americans are human beings like everyone else. We deserve to have, and our children and their children and their children deserve to live in a country where their skin is not their sin. And that movement will continue. No, it will not subside as a result of some, you know, points of reform for police. No.
All right, Paula Peebles, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Paula Peebles is chair of the Pennsylvania chapter of the National Action Network. Following the death of George Floyd, many sports stars spoke out. Some of the conversation was pointed, some of it a bit controversial. We'll talk about that in just a bit with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Mike Sielski. And we're also going to take a look at what is happening in the sports world as leagues try to get those seasons restarted amid and following the worst, hopefully, of the pandemic. So stay with us here. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia and the Radio Times Regional Roundup. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. When the world seems as if it's lost its way, the distraction of sports can serve as a sanity break. And when sports stars speak out, their words and gestures can serve both as balm and a call to action. As reported by Philadelphia sports columnist Mike Sielski recently, Sixers players Tobias Harris and Matisse Thybulle marched side by side with protesters following the death of George Floyd. Eagles quarterback Carson Wentz and tight end Zach Ertz acknowledged the pain and institutional racism endured by the African American community. Of course, 4 years ago, Colin Kaepernick took a knee. And there was also a painful discourse prompted by comments from Saints quarterback Drew Brees. We're going to begin the segment by talking about the moment we're experiencing, and we'll look back a half century before we discuss the latest on sports and the pandemic. There is lots to talk about. Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski is with us now. And Mike, good to have you back with us again.
Always a pleasure, Mary. Thanks for having me.
So the NFL on Friday said it was wrong for not listening to NFL players, and apparently it is encouraging all to peacefully protest that Black Lives Matter. Mike, an extraordinary statement from the NFL?
I don't know if extraordinary is the word I would use. I think groveling might be more appropriate. You know, given the way that the league handled this back in 2016, you know, you can kind of see the folly of its ways now. If the league had just come out with some kind of statement at the time that Colin Kaepernick had begun kneeling in protest of police brutality and said, look, this is within Colin's right to do this. We have no issue with it. Things might have gone a little bit differently than they have since then. But for reasons that were under the NFL's control and some reasons that weren't, I'm looking at you, President Trump, here we are. And I think given everything that's happened over the last week or two in the wake of George Floyd's death, in the wake of the uprising among professional athletes in virtually all sports the NFL included. The NFL had to do a fair bit of, you know, PR and damage control, so they had Commissioner Roger Goodell issue this statement.
Yeah, and unless I'm missing something, there was no mention of Colin Kaepernick in that statement. Colin, the former San Francisco quarterback who, of course, took the knee.
No, there was no mention of him at all. And, you know, it's been such a – it's an amazing thing that, this issue has had the legs that it has had for as long as it has had them. And, you know, it was obviously something that, Eagles fans locally dealt with, you know, because, for instance, the 2017 Super Bowl team featured a number of players who spoke out on social issues, whether it was Malcolm Jenkins, Torrey Smith, Chris Long, you know, many of whom were very supportive of Kaepernick's demonstration and his stand against police brutality. And here we are. And, you know, it's back again. And, you know, that first week of the NFL season, assuming we have an NFL season, and it looks more and more like, you know, the league is going to kind of plow ahead and, do this, that first weekend is going to be interesting because I know media members will be looking to see which players are taking a knee during the anthem, which players aren't. I'm not sure how many fans will care that much. I wonder if they'll just be happy to have football back and would like to get on with the games. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
How are leagues, all sports leagues, moving to address, you know, an atmosphere which has been charged with anger and hurt over the last 2 weeks? Do we know?
I think it's hard to say right now. I think the higher priority is just addressing getting the games going again.
Yeah. How,
you know, what are each of these leagues and their seasons or postseasons going to look like? You know, the NFL, because the season isn't scheduled to start until September anyway, you know, has the most runway here to kind of get things right, just from a logistical standpoint, vis-a-vis coronavirus and the pandemic. Take the protests out of it. You know, you have situations like, yeah, every situation is different. The NBA is, you know, going to have some kind of play-in situation in Orlando. Are they going to be sequestering players and team officials? The NHL is doing kind of a quasi-playoff system. You know, Major League Baseball may not have a season. The owners and the players' union are so far apart on their negotiations. So I think the issue of protest, actually, for these leagues at the moment, might be a little bit of a back burner issue.
Okay, yeah, and we're going to get to that, you know, what the leagues are actually doing as far as the pandemic is concerned in detail, hopefully in just a moment or so. But first, Mike, I'd like to get to an article that, you wrote regarding the year 1964. You know, it's only in recent years that sports figures, particularly those who are Black, have felt somewhat comfortable speaking out and with some risk to career. But in 64, for people who are African-American, it was probably pretty dangerous to speak at all. The city was convulsed by race riots at the time. The Phillies were playing a roller coaster season. And the National League Rookie of the Year was on their team that year, a young Black man named Dick Allen. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, well, he was the star of Philadelphia at the time. He came in and basically was the Phillies' best player right from the jump. You know, had grown up in Wampum, Pennsylvania, was a star right away on a team that, you know, if you remember back to 1964, that was the infamous season in which the Phillies were in first place by 6.5 games with 12 games to play and, of course, collapsed down the stretch. And in August of that year, you know, a mile, a little bit more than a mile from Connie Mack Stadium, you know, race riots break out. You know, they last over a 3-day period, the Columbia Street riots, they're infamous in Philadelphia history. And if you kind of take that situation and put it in the context of today, you know, Dick Allen, he was called Richie at the time, but preferred Dick, was not in a position to speak out in the way that athletes of today are, you know, given, you know, the social and racial, you know, context of that era. It would have taken so much more for him to have spoken out. And I like, you know, drawing that parallel, that idea of, you know, I think we sometimes forget what things were like years ago. We rely on kind of shorthand renditions of what the past was actually like. And, you know, in some respects, you can see how much has changed, how far athletes have come in their willingness and their ability and the forums they have to speak out on issues unrelated to sports. And then you see, of course, that in some ways things haven't changed with respect to, you know, protests and riots and looting about issues and, you know, that we still can't seem to get past.
You know, again, he was the Rookie of the Year. You would have expected him, as you write, to be treated like a king, and he was not. He had to keep his head.
He had to keep his head down for the most part. Now, he became an outspoken player in the years thereafter, a lot of which was because of the way he was treated in 1965 in particular. Sure. Well, that was the year after the riots had taken place. Again, the riots were only about a mile from Connie Mack Stadium. So, you know, you saw the Phillies, for instance, you saw their attendance drop significantly from 1964 to 1965, even though they were still a competitive team, because so many fans, white fans in particular, were fearful of heading down to the ballpark. And I talked to a friend of Dick Allen's who described, you know, taking the 33 bus to Connie Mack Stadium and, you know, protesters throwing things at the bus and the bus full of generally white fans who were going to go to the ballpark. And when they didn't like what the protesters were saying and doing, who did they take it out on? They took it out on Dick Allen, even though he was the team's best player. You know, it was a really it's a sad dynamic because Allen, you know, should have been regarded as I said, a king back then. And his treatment by these fans really led to his kind of truncated career with the Phillies. He should have been here for the entirety of his career. He ended up having some of his best seasons in places like St. Louis and with the Chicago White Sox. And there were some other issues there. He got into a fight with a white teammate named Frank Thomas, who was very popular. The public generally took Thomas's side, even though, you know, there's some dispute about who was actually to blame for the fight. Yeah. So it was a very fraught and complex and really incendiary situation there with Dick Allen in Philadelphia for many years.
Okay. Why don't we take a few minutes to catch up to what's happening with sports? I mean, you mentioned the Sixers. Looks like the target for restarting the season is July 31st. 22-team format. Does this help or hurt the Sixers, which actually have got some injured players back, right?
Yeah, I mean, they should be healthier, which in theory should help them. If you take a look at how they had played during the, whatever it was, 60-some games before the pandemic hit, they were generally regarded as an underwhelming team. They were expected to be a championship contender. They were not playing that way. They were incredibly good at home and incredibly awful on, you know, on the road. So in theory, they should be better that they now that they're healthy. But, you know, they also haven't been together in a very long time. And it's going to be interesting to see if, you know, assuming the games begin again, how the parts that they put together kind of meld. This is one thing the Sixers haven't done in recent years is kind of found a core group and stuck with it. They have Joel Embiid. They have Ben Simmons, who are two young rising stars in the NBA, but they've kind of shaken up the surrounding players around those two. They had a good thing going last year when they had players like J.J. Redick and Jimmy Butler. It had been less successful this season with players like Al Horford and Josh Richardson. The team just didn't have enough outside shooting to complement Embiid and Simmons. So, you know, I think, honestly, Mary, the idea of, like, speculating which team might do well in this kind of abbreviated format, you know, it could be kind of a fool's errand. I mean, if I were to bet, I'd say, okay, well, the Lakers have LeBron James. He's still the best player in the league. They're probably going to do pretty well. Anything beyond that, it would be just pure speculation.
Wait, rules for play during the coronavirus, do we know?
I'm sorry, say that again?
What are the rules for play, if there are any, for, you know, having kind of picking up a mini season during the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I don't think they're going to change the games at all. I think it's simply going to be a matter
of...
I'm sorry?
You can't change the games. I mean, it's a physical game,
no,
basketball.
No, you can't. You can't change the rules in the middle of the game. So there's going to be testing in and out of the arena. That's the plan anyway. But once the game begins and there's bumping and fouling and jumping and sweating and all of the breathing and all of those things, the games can't change. So the NBA, you know, is going to have to be particularly rigorous about, you know, how they police, so to speak, interactions with players during the game and even before and after a game. You know, it isn't football where you're out in an outer area, you're outside, generally speaking. That seems to be, you know, where there's less risk for transmission. I'm certainly not, you know, a doctor or anything like that. But, yeah, I mean, the NBA has talked about that, about how rigorous they're going to have to be in terms of making sure their players are safe.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not a physician either, but it would seem that the NHL, which the players are wearing a lot more gear, you know, it might not be quite as dire an issue as it might, not dire, that's a really big word, but quite as much of an issue as it might be for the Sixers. We will see. To the Flyers briefly, Mike. Looks like early August the season might pick up.
Yeah, you know, just the time of year where everybody's thinking of hockey. You know, you want, you know, hockey in August. But it's looking that way. Assuming the plan as the NHL has set it forth so far publicly is approved and goes forward, the Flyers would actually be one of four teams in the Eastern Conference to get a kind of a quasi-bye. They would be one of the top four teams. Those teams would kind of play a round-robin sort of tournament to determine seeding. And then the other 12 teams, I think it's 12 or however many below them, would play, you know, a first-round playoff series to advance. Yeah, I guess it would be 8 teams below them, excuse me. And then the four teams that won that those intermittent playoff rounds would advance, and they would play one of the top four seeds, and then you'd kind of go with like a regular old playoff series from there. But yeah, they have two hubs. They're going to pick two hub cities to hold all these games. I mean, there are so many details that have to be worked out. And, you know, if we've learned anything over the last 3 or 4 months, it's that this virus can really throw a monkey wrench into about any plan you might have.
Well, just briefly, the headline on one of your recent articles reads, given the Flyers' tortured history, this would be the perfect year for them to win the Stanley Cup. You've got about 30 seconds. Why?
Well, they figured out every other way to not win the Stanley Cup over the last 45 years. So the idea of them, you know, ending that championship drought in a year, in this year of all years with coronavirus and, you know, 2020 being just the craziest, you know, most ridiculous year we've come across in a long time for a lot of reasons, it seems kind of perfect to me.
In any of the pro sports leagues, Mike Sielski, whichever teams come out on top, you know, as champions, like maybe the Flyers with the Stanley Cup, would they go into the books with an asterisk?
I wouldn't regard it that way. I don't think most fans would regard it that way. I'm sure it probably will, though. You know, historians and you know, my, you know, junior Bob Costas's, I guess, would look at it that way. But I think, you know, if the Flyers were to win the Stanley Cup, for instance, I don't think the people, you know, Flyers fans in the Delaware Valley would mind too much, even if there were an asterisk beside it.
All right, so just briefly back to Major League Baseball. You know, again, before anybody hits the field, the league and the union have to come to terms on the pandemic, on changes wrought by the pandemic. And correct me if I'm wrong, there's a standoff with the clock ticking?
That is correct, yes. They, you know, they're really at an impasse, the owners and the players union. And Faye Vincent, the former commissioner of Major League Baseball, was quoted somewhere recently, I'm not sure where, it might have been the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, is saying the one thing that Rob Manfred, the current commissioner, has to understand is that he's not going to break the players' union. Baseball's union has traditionally been the strongest of the four major sports leagues in this country. And, you know, they are at an absolute impasse. And, you know, the owners are demanding the players, you know, basically redo or rework an agreement for prorated salaries based on the number of games played. The players don't want to do that. I don't blame the players for that. And here we are. And it's very possible that we will not have baseball played in 2020.
Can the league unilaterally implement a season of, what, about 50 games if the union doesn't renegotiate the agreement reached March 26th? I mean, is it likely we might have a mini season?
Well, I mean, you're talking about bringing in, you know, replacement players or scab players then.
Yeah.
The union seems pretty united to me. On this regard, you know, they have something to lose too. I mean, there was an agreement in March that the players would get $170 million dispersed among themselves to kind of tide them over, with the understanding that, you know, they would then get paid once the games resume. But the owners are asking them to redo basically that agreement, that proration. So, you know, they're playing chicken right now, and the owners aren't going to be able to create a season without the players' agreement and assent in this regard.
All right, as they say, stay tuned. Mike Sielski, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Mary.
All right, thank you. Mike Sielski is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget to visit us on social media. We're at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us today for Radio Times. Be well.